This is an international podcast transmission. Is anyone out there? If you're listening, you've reached the No Fixed Agenda podcast.
Welcome, everybody, to No Fixed Agenda presented by Bubs Naturals. I'm your host, Jeff Stoner. Thank you for joining us on another journey across the podcast airwaves today, and a journey it was. We brought in Brenda Stevens of the Stevens Therapy Associates. Brenda specializes in narcissism and family trauma or abuse of narcissists. So needless to say, this was a very informative episode and very interesting episode to listen to. Unfortunately, narcissist and narcissism are two trendy words nowadays, mainly, I think, from a political aspect as well. If you know who I'm talking about, great. But it is a trendy topic, and it makes it for a very interesting topic because of that. And I think the word narcissist gets thrown around a little bit too lightly sometimes. So it was nice to have an educational perspective of what actually narcissist is and how they affect the relationships they've got around them. So yeah, I hope you guys enjoy this one. This was so informative, and I can't thank Brenda Stevens for coming in and breaking everything down for us. And we just touched the surface of this topic. And in hopes maybe we can get her back in and we can talk another angle of it. But from a family abuse perspective, I thought this was very interesting. So, and if you are somebody who's listening in this and has dealt with a narcissist or has been in a narcissistic relationship before, and you're in, at least in San Diego, Brenda Stevens and Stevens Therapy Associates specializes in this. So you may want to go and chat with them a little bit about everything. But yeah, I hope you guys get something out of this. This was unbelievable. So thanks again, guys, and welcome, Brenda Stevens.
This is No Fixed Agenda, brought to you by Bubs Natural. Their mission statement is simple: live better, live longer. Bubs helps fuel people to reach their maximum human potential through supplements sourced from nature's highest quality ingredients while giving 10% of all proceeds back to charity. Learn more about their NSF Sports Certified Collagen Peptides and Electrolyte Drink Mix at BubsNaturals.com.
This is going to be a therapy session for me.
Yeah. It always is. Every time I do one of these.
Yeah? You're like, yeah. You want me to tell you in a public forum?
Everybody's worried about it. Everyone that I talk, when I've done these interviews, everyone is like, when we start talking, we all have traits. We all have narcissistic traits. And people get, they hear me say something and I think it strikes a chord and they're like, oh, that sounds like something. And I see people get nervous and a little bit more quiet.
Yeah, because they're like, oh, do I have the traits? And then they like, oh, yeah, back off a little bit.
Keep it quiet. I'm saying nothing.
I'm just providing knowledge here. That's all.
Hey, that's all we want. Yeah. Jeff and I have been looking forward to this conversation.
Oh, good.
Jeff in particular was very excited to have it.
And I think that's the big thing now is narcissist or narcissism is a trendy word, which really drives me crazy.
Me too.
And I think that's driven by politics.
Well, certainly.
I think it's driven by social media,
especially social media.
And it just compounds on top of one another. And I think that is the reason I wanted to have this conversation is because there's definitely, I think narcissists sometimes get a bad rap in some regard, right? Everybody always feels like a narcissist is intently mean.
Yes.
And they're not. Some definitely can be. There's a lot of, we've talked about that. A lot of areas you can go down, but I think it is definitely not talked about properly enough.
It's not.
As far as what the traits and symptoms and how people can work with or talk with. And that's, so again, coming back to it, and it's, so before we get too much farther down the road, please introduce yourself. Uh-huh. And then as I prepped you.
Yes.
So introduce yourself. We like to start the show off too by a little bit of fun before we get into the conversation.
Serious stuff. Yeah.
So what would be your podcast Tinder profile? What is your elevator
pitch? Yeah, you did ask me about that, and I'm so bad at elevator pitches. But I will say, I work with narcissistic abuse survivors, and this is a population that is incredibly underserved in the mental health field. And I feel I've had my own experience. What brought me into doing this work is my own experience with a narcissistic family member and a narcissistic partner who I had children with. And so my, I guess what draws me to the work and what I want people to know is that you need to work when you are in a narcissistic relationship of any type, family member, whatever it is, a coworker, whatever it is, talking to somebody who gets it is, it's crucially important because people hear stories about what narcissistic people do and they go, oh, it doesn't sound that bad. Or why didn't you just leave? That's a big one. Why don't you just walk away? And that's not possible. It's not possible. The more in meshed in the relationship that you're in. I guess this isn't a very good elevator pitch, but
it's a long ride.
Yeah.
It's a long ride.
I'm sorry.
It's
yeah, it's really not.
You should have told her 5 words or less. Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. It's all good.
I guess my elevator pitch, I'll say this, is that talk to somebody that gets it and believes your story.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, that was way better. I could have done it. Sorry.
It's all good. No worries.
Yeah. Somebody who understands it and gets it.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's, before we get into everything, I'd love to hear your background really quick. And you'd said previously before we got on air, you've been doing this now for 20 years.
Yes.
Did you start in San Diego? Are you from another location and moved here? And then what got you into not only therapy, but into the realm of narcissism?
So no, I was born here in San Diego and lived here most of my life, moved away for a while and then came back. But what got me into the narcissism, this is a dumb joke, but it's true.
We like jokes. Okay. We like to laugh.
Well, good. Because what happened when I opened my private practice when I moved back to San Diego about 10 years ago, all these women kept coming in. Women come to therapy more than men do. So this is why I say women. But all these women kept coming to me and telling me these stories about their partners. I was like, are they dating my ex? Ooh. And I swear to God, I really thought at first, like, maybe he cheated on me all the time. And he was married at the time. I thought it's very possible.
Maybe he's been with all my patients.
These stories are just way, way too familiar. But that wasn't the case. At least as far as I know, that wasn't the case. But what I did learn from that was that narcissists all behave in a very same way. And I always use this analogy that it seems like they have a playbook that they all operate from. The behavior is so similar from one to another, which is why it looks so familiar to me when I would have these clients. But that's what started it. And at that time, so that was only 10 years ago when I really started specializing in this, there was no information about narcissistic abuse out there, except for Dr. Romani, she's like the guru of this topic. But she was the only person that I had to go to for any kind of resources. To this day, there's really no research on it. I'm actually starting a PhD program, which is going to be my focus of research, not narcissism specifically, but narcissistic abuse, because I am one of few therapists in the whole country that works with this population.
Wow.
So,
really?
Yeah, it's just, there's becoming more and more. But when you look at how many therapists there are over just in the U.S., there are very few of us that do this work. And San Diego's a microcosm of that.
Is there a reason for that?
Therapists aren't taught this in grad school. None of us are. We're taught about narcissism. And this is what I was saying earlier in my too long elevator pitch. what I've had happen is a lot of people coming, because now I'm known for doing this work. People Google in San Diego specifically, especially narcissistic abuse, they're going to find me as a therapist if that's what they're looking for, a therapist for this. What happens though is people will Google however they find their therapist, and they'll ask the therapist, do you know about narcissism? Yes, most therapists do know about narcissism. They don't know what it looks like in relationship, and they don't know all of the things that happen to the person who's the victim of the narcissist. And I choose the word victim intentionally. A lot of people don't like to use that word, but I can't think of a better one because a narcissist is typically predatory. And what is a predator looking for but a victim? So other therapists will say that they know what narcissism is, but they don't understand that victim-predator relationship. So a client will go to a therapist with all good intentions, and I think the therapist has good intentions too, but then the client has then wasted time and maybe been re-traumatized because they'll tell their story and a therapist will look at it through a lens of a normal relationship or even an emotionally abusive relationship and not see the nuances and the constant kind of pecking away at the victim that the narcissist does. And you said earlier, not intentional. I disagree with that.
Oh, really?
I do.
Okay.
I do. Because to me, the difference between emotional abuse and narcissistic abuse is the intentionality.
Okay. Wow.
Where I will give you some grace in my disagreement to that is that I think there's a whole pathway to how somebody becomes narcissistic, and that's often, almost always, from childhood abuse or neglect that they experience themselves. So they've learned a way to wear this mask and behave in a certain way that gets them through this abuse and neglect. And it's something they learn and it compounds over years and years. So by the time they're in adulthood and they're in these relationships, it's second nature to be abusive. So I don't think they wake up in the morning and go, how am I going to abuse my partner today? But it is intentional. And there's a lack of empathy with them that is the biggest part of this problem.
I want to stay on the topic of narcissism, but I've also been part of like abusive relationships. Mm-hmm. And would you say that the behavior between an abusee mm-hmm. or somebody that's being abused by narcissism would similar patterns to like physical abuse?
Or very much so.
Emotional abuse. Even I've been in a home where there's like fathers and like spousal abuse.
Yeah.
And as you're describing narcissism and the behavior in the family unit, a lot of triggers are coming in my head.
Yeah.
And so would you say it's the same?
It's not the same. It's certainly in the same category, right? Mm-hmm. And you'll see a lot, like there's, I wish I could speak in pictures, but there's
whiteboard. You want a whiteboard?
A whiteboard would be great with colored markers, please. So there's a cycle of abuse that happens where there's like a calm and a buildup and then the abuse and then a calm and a buildup and abuse. It's similar in all abusive relationships. There's another piece of it in narcissistic abuse where there's love bombing and this repair thing that in narcissism, it builds this, there's literally a chemical response going on in the body with dopamine and serotonin and all of that stuff, not to get to science. But it is an addictive cycle. It is for all types of abuse, but in narcissistic abuse, the discard, sorry, I'm going to quit talking with my hands.
No, you can move it if you want.
It's okay.
I like talking with my hands too, so I'm with you on this one. Okay. That's why it's away from me. Look. Yeah.
That's wise. But there's this buildup. So, sorry, I'm trying to filter ahead of time how much to go into. Mm-hmm. But there's this buildup that happens where there's, again, the cycle where there's calm, buildup, abuse. But there's this anticipation from the victim that the calm's going to come. And there's such an addiction to that. So so much build up and over the cycle happens, the victim then becomes addicted to the calm again. Mm. So that piece is in there and it's just this cycle that is just brutal. It's really brutal.
It's almost like addictive behavior where you're always looking for that same rush that you get from the beginning, that first hit. There's a term in addictive, in the addict world, right? In addictive therapy. We're always chasing that first high.
Yep.
And so it sounds very similar to this.
It is very similar. And there's also, I can't think of the term of it with addiction too, but there's the routine, like an addict filling up their needle with heroin, that part. All of that is in this too, in that buildup, in that I know I'll just get through this abusive period, this abusive cycle, because I know that good stuff's coming and it is the hit. It absolutely is the same thing.
Yeah. Family members that have been in abusive relationships in my life have always, when you're a young man, you want to protect your loved ones from abuse, from bad things happening. But in an abusive relationship or an abusive cycle that you just described right now, they always go back to the abuser.
Yep.
And so as a child, I beat up the person that was causing the abuse. I want to beat his butt. You know, get out. You don't need to hear him. And then 2 days later, they're right back. The abusee goes back to the abuser.
Yeah.
And it's, what am I doing? So I quickly learned in the abusive cycle that the cycle has to be broken by either the abusee.
Yeah, that's it right there. It has to be broken by the person who's experiencing the abuse, because all the narcissist is going to do is go find somebody else.
Yeah.
And they probably already have somebody else. I always think of it like just a little pool of supply there for them.
Yeah. It's almost like they're always on the hunt for the next person.
Again, and like a predator. Yeah. That's exactly it. They're on the hunt, but they do keep a backup supply. This is very common. They're flirty. They'll talk to other members of whomever they're attracted to, but they always have somebody waiting in the wings.
What is... I'm sorry.
Go ahead. You're good, dude.
I guess the thing is, somebody who's listening to this podcast or any of the podcasts that you've been on or anything else about narcissism, I guess, what are there some right away telltale signs of somebody who is a narcissist?
Yeah.
I was going like the same question, because I really want... What are those traits? What is the person that's being abused by a narcissism should be looking for?
Yeah.
Like the term, to Jeff's point, has been just tossed out. Oh, you're a narcissist. And it's, wait a minute. It's almost like calling somebody an addict who's never used drugs before.
Yes.
And it's, come on, dude, just because you don't like the way that person or he or she said, like, that you can't use that term.
No.
And so what are those traits?
A lack of empathy is the big one. And you'll see that in many ways. Even going, say you're on a first date with somebody and they're really cruel to the wait staff. That would be a huge red flag. And just the way people talk in a dismissive way about things that hopefully most of us care about, like our family members or something, a narcissist is going to be and not have empathy for them either. And just empathy in a caring, kind way toward another human being, right? It doesn't even have to be about something serious, but the wait staff, that's a big one. Lack of empathy is a theme that runs through all narcissistic relationships. And to the point too about everyone being a narcissist, I think what we're doing now is calling anybody that has selfish tendencies narcissistic, and that is absolutely not what narcissism is. It's a whole system of other behaviors. Shame is a big one too. You're not going to see that early on in a relationship, but shame is what drives narcissism, in my opinion. And I've thought about this a lot. Shame is a big piece of this. Also, shame is a big piece of their victims. So I hear people say all the time too, are narcissists looking specifically for empaths? No, I firmly believe the answer to that question is no. What I think happens is those with higher empathy let narcissists stay longer. I really think that's the case, because people with empathy are like they're giving them an out. He didn't mean it, or she only acts that way on Sundays. Or
I see it from their side.
Exactly. Trying to put themselves in the shoes of the narcissist. But somebody with empathy is never going to be able to think the way a narcissist thinks. So they try to make it make sense in their empathic brain, but you can't make sense of a lack of empathy person through an empathy lens. So I think there's a lot of confusion with somebody who has empathy that has a narcissist in their life, and it leads to cognitive dissonance. So which is a term that just means what it means in this sense is that they believe the image that they first had of that person. So that person was probably very charming. And I'm thinking of a partner relationship, right? The person is typically very charming. It's love bombing. That's a common term used in narcissistic language. So what they do is they study their victims, like the new person they meet, whether it's a friend, the supply that they're keeping on the sides, or a partner. They study and they mirror the person that they're trying to charm, basically. So they learn everything about that person and they compliment. They're overly kind. They're showing the best version of what they think a human being should look like. They don't really know what that is, but they're trying to imitate that. So when the abuse starts and the red flags start popping up, a person who doesn't think like a narcissist makes excuses. And that's what cognitive dissonance is. They say, oh, this isn't really who they are. They're really that person that I met originally, who was so kind, and they really know me. And that's a big one, because they've studied you. They're mirroring things back to you. So we think we have this really deep connection because they know so much and they really get us. Yeah. But that's part of the ploy.
That's part of the hunting.
It is part of it. Yeah.
It's part of the hunt. Now, you talk about it referring to from a relationship, like a dating perspective, yeah, right? Or a spouse. What does it look like from a parent perspective?
Yeah. So this is troubling. This is very difficult for folks to understand. And I don't think people would even realize it until they're well into adulthood, if ever, that they were raised by a narcissistic parent. Yeah. But it's so incredibly damaging. The children of narcissists don't have the opportunity to grow up in a way that we think like normal. There's no normal, but right, what we think normal childhood should look like. So a child of a narcissist is walking on eggshells constantly. They're categories that we talk about with narcissistic parents. A narcissistic parent typically assigns roles. They don't say, today you're, but they have a golden child, a lost child, a scapegoat typically. And there's other terms too, but I see those three as being enough to cover.
Basically. Lost child, golden child, and a scapegoat.
Yep. And one child, so you can have one child in the family and they'll be assigned each role, depending on the day or the month, whatever it is, just depending on how the narcissist feels. And the golden child, I always have to, I feel like I need to do a caveat here, because a golden child, it may sound like the preferred role to be assigned in a family like this. It's just as damaging, if not more so, than all of the roles, because this child is being given the praise and then is so dependent on that praise. Yeah. They're living their whole life trying to meet the bar that's always changing. Right?
Wow.
So there's no peace in a narcissistic family. And like I said, in the scapegoat, forget about it. Like they grow up thinking they're responsible for everything.
Yeah.
Everything that goes wrong. Exactly. Exactly. Wow. And then all three of them will end up being very people pleaser type. They're apologizing a lot. I speak from experience. It's damaging no matter what the role is. And then if you think about the role shifting all the time, the kids are constantly on high alert. And then they grow up being hypervigilant and in survival mode. They don't get even to develop the strong sense of self they would normally develop had that not been happening.
Wow.
It's very sad.
Does it? I guess from a, let's call it with a son and daughter, is there a typical that it would, one versus the other would be treated differently because they are the daughter or because they are the son? Is that, or does it really matter?
Honestly, I don't think it really matters. I think it depends on the narcissist. So I'll use my experience specifically. So my narcissist, I hate to call him that, but the narcissistic person I was partnered with, how about that, is Hispanic. So he comes from a culture where he has a vision of what a man should look like. He didn't do this with my son so much, but with his second wife, who I'm very close with, in their family, he had a son who's older and a younger daughter. And there was a big discrepancy there. The daughter was the pride and joy, the apple of his eye, and the son was his like repository for everything he hated about himself. And there was a lot of expectation that the son did well in sports and anyway, be a protector for his sister. It was really damaging for them. So I think it depends on a lot of moving parts. Like how does the narcissist see himself? Sees himself as being really macho and tough and strong and all of that. So I think he just put his values on his son. In families, it can look like anything. It doesn't necessarily, it's not necessarily based on gender. There is a dynamic with mothers and daughters, though.
Yeah, I'd like to hear that.
Yeah.
I want to hear that. Yeah. But I'm going to go back to Hispanics because I'm Hispanic and I was raised in a certain very similar scenario. It never made sense to me. Machismo was the word.
Yes.
But it did, as you described narcissism, it seems very much like what they described what a male should be in this culture.
Yeah.
And so how much, before you get into the mothering role of a narcissist, how much of some of these narcissistic traits, is it something that they're born with or is it something that they taught? Is it something like culturally in your experience? Do you know?
That's a really good question. I think about the culture piece a lot. It's not something that they're born with as far as we know. There's more research coming out mostly from Australia. For some reason, they're way ahead of the game that is noticing a genetic piece, but they're not. It's not like the cause. I think we're looking at maybe some genetic predisposition to personality disorders in general. Mm. And then environment plays a huge role. Environment, I think, plays a bigger role than the genetic piece. But that's just my colloquial or my anecdotal take on it. I'm fully convinced that it comes from shame. So if a kid is raised by a narcissistic parent, they're being shamed all the time because they're never good enough, right? Mm. So again, the kid's trying to prove themselves. This is usually generational. I should have said that first. So there's some toxicity in the parent that's raising the kid that turns out to be a narcissist. And that child never gets a chance to develop a true sense of self. But what they learn early on is to how to act in this situation. And that's what I was saying earlier, like it compounds and builds upon itself over years of just generations and years of getting better at it. They learn new skills all the time. Skills.
So, yeah. It is a skill.
Yeah, it is. It is. And then culturally speaking, I'm a white woman, so I want to be very careful and I want to be very respectful.
Oh, nothing you say to me is going to offend me. So yeah. Go ahead, live out. Okay. And I think Mexicans need to hear this.
Well,
opinion.
The machismo thing is a shit show, if I may say that.
Yeah.
Right. It's not helpful to anybody. It puts a dynamic between men and women that is not healthy. And it puts an expectation on men, I think, that is also not healthy. If you're having to swallow your emotion all the time, what do you do with it? And as a therapist, I think we should all be expressing our emotion all the time, obviously in healthy ways and in ways that feel safe to us. But if you're holding that in all the time, it's going to come out as anger. And then you can see how that would look narcissistic. It may not be narcissistic, but it's going to be anger misdirected in places it doesn't belong. And there's other cultures too, where there's this deference to parents in a way that I don't know, that's not how I would want to treat my parents, and I would not want my children to treat me that way, like this, basically giving up my life because my parent needs something. I don't think that's fair. I think that can look like narcissism. And I've had San Diego's got a large Filipino population. I've had a lot of Filipino clients.
The cultures are very similar.
Yeah.
From Hispanic to Filipinos.
Yeah.
Extremely, very similar.
Yeah. And there's expectation of, I know in Filipino culture too, there's an expectation of the eldest daughter that leads to what looks very much like a narcissistic dynamic with the parents, because the parents expect the daughter to be there at their beck and call, basically. So it's tricky, culturally speaking. There's a book that talks about this called What My Bones Know, and it's written by Stephanie Fu, I think is her name. So she's a mixed Asian cultures, and I can't think of what they are, but she explains it very nicely in the book too about the crossover there.
And so this leads me to the next question that hopefully guides you into the relationship, the special dynamic between a mom who's a narcissist. Mm-hmm. You mentioned something that caught my ear, which is in the male aspect of narcissism, or even cultural aspect of narcissism, is it commonly for the narcissist to inflict their cycle on a particular person in the family, aka a parent, into a child, right?
Yes.
Their shame?
Absolutely.
It's like from my own personal experience of me being raised, like in Mexican culture, you're the oldest male. It's your responsibility. It's you're this, you're that, you're this. And it's immediately was like pounded into my head that I had to fill a certain role, not allowing me to be the person, which later on in my life turned into resentment towards my family. But it was the shame.
Yes.
That was projected onto me that I learned early on, later on in my life, that I didn't want to project onto my children.
Yeah. I call people like you chain breakers. Like, you're breaking that chain of abuse.
Thank you.
So well done. That's something to be proud of.
Thank you.
Yeah. But shame is what it's all about. And the whole point, I guess the point of narcissism, if there is one, is that they can't hold on to the shame. They can't feel it. They have no emotional IQ, or EQ we call it, emotional intelligence, basically, to manage what they feel. And again, I think this personality disorder is born from shame, and because they can't feel it, they dump it on everybody else. And here's the key, the big key for me: if you have a narcissist around you and you see them rage or act really bad on their worst behavior, I think it's important to put an age on the rage, because that gives you a picture into where their emotional development stopped, the age that they stopped.
Interesting. What do you mean by age and the rage?
When a narcissist rages, they usually rage from throwing a fit, like a toddler or something. Mm-hmm. You'll see very immature emotional behavior from them. And if you can look at them and go, oh, that looks like an 8-year-old, you're probably onto something there. Like, they're probably operating from an 8-year-old emotional intelligence.
Wow. That just blew it, dude. Blew my mind, bro. If you didn't explain that, I would have been like, age on the rage. What is that?
Yeah.
Is it how long they've been raging? Is it a 5-minute raging period? Or is
Yeah,
that is amazing. Really? And do you think, as we talk Do you think that usually there, whatever is like an age on the rig, you say, well, that looks like an 8-year-old behavior. Mm-hmm. Is it usually you think it's, you believe it's from a trauma that was at that age? Or is that?
Yeah. What I think is that it could be from a trauma, but what I really think is it's the point where they started to become self-aware enough to realize they had to perform almost, behave a certain way for their toxic parent or for their environment so that they could survive. So the focus of growing up stopped and they focused outwardly. How do I get what I need? Kids need unconditional love. A child who ends up being a narcissist has not gotten unconditional love in their childhood. So they're finding ways to get that need met, but in very unhealthy ways. Right. So their emotional development stops because they're basically in survival mode. Their survival mode ends up being super toxic when they have adult relationships, when they get older, or even teenage, when the personality disorder starts to develop. But yeah, it's coming from their toxic parents, it arrests their development. And they go through life wearing this mask of, now they're an adult with this mask on, but they're a little child inside emotionally.
Wow. Like I said this to somebody, I'm going to mess my children up, but I'm going to mess my children up less than my parents.
Yes.
Me up.
Yeah. Yes. I've said that to myself.
Yeah, I'm going to ruin my child, but it's not going to be as bad as I was ruined.
I don't know how many times. Yeah.
And so talk to us about the relationship between a mom narcissism.
So mother-daughter relationships can be tricky regardless. I think any mother and probably any parent is going to see themselves in their child to some degree. With a mother, though, a narcissistic mother typically has zero boundaries between her and her daughter. Wow. She might have a little bit more with a son, but with the daughter, the enmeshment is strong. And that means there's just no separation between the mother and the daughter, basically. The mother, again, dumps all of her shame into the daughter and then the daughter acts accordingly. I'm not good enough. Oh, I'm sorry for existing, basically. But the mother expects to be a part of every bit of the daughter's life. I don't want my mom to listen to this, but there are conversations I've had with my own mother that I should never have had. She should never have talk to me about sexual exploits or things like that. Mothers, that's just inappropriate conversation. And it doesn't have to be sexual. Anything that's inappropriate between a conversation or behavior between a mother and daughter, the narcissistic mother will not see the boundary. And then again, the daughter does not have the chance to develop in a way that she should and understand who she is. She will maybe start acting like her mother too. There may be times where she hears her mother's voice coming out of her own mouth and be shocked by it. And this is where they usually end up in therapy. And I realize I didn't probably answer the question fully, but it's the enmeshment, basically. It's the lack of boundaries. For some reason, fathers typically will have a little bit more distance if it's a narcissistic father, but a narcissistic mother just does not allow there to be a boundary and a separation between herself and her children. She'll do it with the male children too. But the daughter gets the, I think everything the mother hates about herself is just dumped into the daughter.
Is it because they're female and female?
I think so. I think that women just tend to relate to one another in a different way, I think, than male and female and male, or any other gender. I don't want to be excluding anybody, right. But I just think there's an expectation from the narcissistic mother that she be allowed into everything in her daughter's life because I'm your mother and you're my daughter. And the narcissistic mother sees the daughter simply as an extension of herself.
Wow.
So she does not see a boundary there. She sees, I can do whatever I want. I can talk about whatever I want. I can expect anything I want from you. And she doesn't think she's doing anything wrong.
And almost like she deserves to know exactly what's going on.
Absolutely. It is exactly like that. She feels she deserves to know everything.
In this particular story, we said this earlier in the conversation, it takes the person that's being abused by the narcissist to stop the behavior. What is one of the things that you would recommend from a male to female perspective? If I think, and you could correct me if I'm wrong, some of it from a male perspective, in my experience, is that men are just not emotionally more available.
Yeah.
And so they just, either it's out of sight, out of mind, or I don't know how to feel.
Yes.
I had to learn how to feel because I was not taught that.
Yep.
And I was not taught that it was okay to cry.
Yep.
I was told not to cry. I was told to man up.
Yeah.
And so is that the boundaries between a male, a mom, we're talking about mom have narcissism right now, into a male, is it just harder for them to do that? For the mom to show, for the mom to see as the male child as being an extension for them? Is that?
Yes, yeah. I think so. I think so, because I think for women and a narcissistic mother specifically, she's going to see a stronger relate, like a, not a relationship in a good way, but she sees herself and her daughter. She can see a difference between herself and her son. And that's not to say she's treating her son well. It's just different, no, right? Yeah. It's just different. The enmeshment isn't as strong with the son, I think, as with the daughter. Again, I don't know that a narcissistic mother really sees that there's a difference between her and her child.
Wow.
I really believe that. I think the difference with a male child is undeniable. That child's going to look a lot different, even if there's facial similarities or whatever. There's going to be a stronger difference. So I think maybe that might be the place where it shifts. Also, I think, I don't know if it's generational or not either, but I think their narcissists tend to have an idea of how people should act. They have these expectations. You're a man, you should act like a man. You're a woman, you should be dainty and act like a dainty woman. And I think that probably plays a role too. With a narcissistic mother, she may expect her son to, you're a man, you don't cry. And what a horrible thing to do to your child.
That's an interesting thing. You talk generationally and the way that society is now versus the 60s and 70s.
Yeah.
Where men are supposed to be stoic and not mm-hmm. cry, and women are supposed to be, like you said, dainty and homemakers. And,
yes.
And how everything has changed now. That's actually an interesting thing to look at as far as how the narcissists in this generation act as, hey, as a male, what is that supposed to be? What are you, like, what's the male supposed to be now at this point in time, right? Yes, you're still supposed to be the masculine deal, but with the way everything is looked at in society, it's a little bit interesting to me.
It is.
And how a narcissist would perceive what they're supposed to act like.
What would you say to, it just sounds so overwhelming for female with a narcissistic mom. And they're so ingrained, like you mentioned, and it's almost, there's a term equally yoked in marriage, right? And so it's almost, this is the vision that I have. It's like, how does the abusee of a narcissistic mom who's a female cut off her arm or create boundaries?
The little steps. Really. And there's a term in narcissistic abuse language called gray rocking. And the idea behind it is that you're as dull as a gray rock, because a narcissist parent, partner, coworker, whatever it is, they're going to be trying to get a reaction out of you. Yeah. They're trying to build something up there. And the idea of gray rocking is just not responding, honestly, the way that they want you to. It's being dull. It's literally being dull as a gray rock. So they try to goad you into an argument or something and you just don't react. Don't respond. And it's incredibly hard to do, because this dynamic has probably been going on for years. Yeah. And it's incredibly hard to do. And I think a lot of people see it as giving up, but honestly, you're not giving up. You're giving into peace, right? Mm. You're bringing peace into your life by not.
That is powerful right there.
It's so important. And this is where I see the recovery from narcissistic abuse as being so challenging, is first of all, recognizing what's going on often happens when adults have their own children. And I know, again, my mom doesn't listen, but I know for me, when I had my first child, I held her and I was like, oh my God, this is what love is. I had no idea. And I assume every parent feels like that. But then this thought started going, I don't think my mom ever felt like this about me. And I think this is how people start to become aware. They have their own children, or they get into a relationship where they start to notice similarities between their partner and their home life. What I've seen the most happen, and again, I mostly work with women because mostly women come to therapy, but what I see happen is they get a partner and they go, I see a lot of narcissistic traits. And as we start doing the work, they go, oh, wait a minute. This is a lot like my dad, or a lot like my mom or my grandma or whoever it is. Mm-hmm. So they'll start to see the connection, but it's almost always generational. And I think I veered off.
But it is generational, but you go into the gray rocking, you said?
Yeah, gray rocking, yes.
Gray rocking. And so not responding, in other words, of like... turning the other cheek, if you will.
Turning the other cheek. I like to think of it too, like not taking the bait, because they're constantly trying to bait you.
Oh, they're hunting.
They're hunting, exactly. Right?
That analogy from a person that's being abused by a narcissist mm-hmm. is so powerful.
Yes.
And it's like you realize that everything that narcissist is putting in the abuser's path is to bait them.
That's it. And that's the difference between emotional abuse and narcissistic, or physical abuse and narcissistic abuse. It is strategic and planned and well thought out. And going back to intentionality again, I don't think they wake up in the morning and say, this is my plan for the day. And this is how I'm going to strategize how to control you. But it's just ingrained in who they are. By the time they become an adult, they know how to do it so incredibly well.
Is gray rocking, would that be considered the start of the healing process? Or is the gray rocking something that, can be carried out in the long term?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. It should be carried out in the long term if the narcissistic person isn't making attempts to change or improve their behavior, which they won't. They just won't. Narcissists will go to therapy or say that they'll go to counsel at church or whatever it is, and they'll try to manipulate whomever is providing the counsel. And if that doesn't work, and it, unfortunately, if they get somebody who's not aware of this, the therapist or whomever might be manipulated because they don't see the problem. Like the person's putting on their best face, right? So they won't see the problem. If the therapist does see the problem, the narcissist is going to say, oh, they're no good. They don't know what they're doing. And then they won't stay in therapy. This is very common. A lot of times a spouse will bring their narcissistic spouse into couples therapy as an attempt to kind of repair the relationship. And this, to me, this is where it starts to crumble, right? Because now the mask is getting lifted.
That's going to be the toughest thing because you might not even know that they're a narcissist at that point. And you come into couples therapy and you're learning that in real time.
Yeah.
And that's where it has to be like really hard.
It's tricky.
So have you ever seen a narcissist break the pattern? Yeah. In most cases, let's say somebody, I'll talk age now. I guess I was blessed enough to go through some traumatic events and be on both sides of the abuse and the abuser. And so I can go, well, that was pretty wild. And oh, this felt like this because I was the abusee. Yeah. And so have you ever seen a narcissist change their ways?
No, but what you're describing, that insight of, oh, this is what this felt like when I was abused, is something a narcissist doesn't do, right? Mm. That's self-reflection. That's empathy. That's putting yourself in somebody else's shoes. Narcissist doesn't do that. No. I have a client who I thought that her and her husband went through really like some intensive therapy sessions with a therapist up north. I thought there might be a chance, but after years, it wasn't. I do think narcissism falls on a spectrum. Like you'll have some people with some narcissistic traits all the way up to a malignant narcissist who's almost a sociopath. And there is a difference. But I thought he was maybe lower on the spectrum and could make it work. But no, I just don't think there's.
So there is a spectrum?
Yes.
Wow. Yeah. So what is the extreme and what is like you mentioned that we all have narcissistic
exactly.
traits.
We do. And especially if you're raised by a narcissist. So you're going to notice, again, like I said earlier, you hear your parents' voice coming out of your mouth or the words that they would use and you go, oh, my God. If you don't go, oh, my God, then that's a problem. Right.
Yeah.
But and also there's things like narcissistic traits probably help me get into grad school or helps you guys do a podcast. Or, yeah. And those are good. That's what we want. We need to have that to give us the confidence to do what we want to do in life. It's when it becomes predatory and intentionally painful toward other people where it becomes a problem. And even that spectrum, I wouldn't put us on that spectrum of narcissism. I hope to God I'm not a narcissist. I worry about it too sometimes. But it's people who can be intentionally cruel, I think that's always a problem. Minor intentional cruelty, I think, is on the low end. Malignant narcissism is over here where they're out, like, really hunting
people. Like, I woke up and I want to, where's my next victim?
Exactly. Yeah. And just really almost no empathy. And when we have zero empathy, we move over into sociopathic, antisocial personality disorder, serial killer kind of stuff.
That was going to be my next question,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
If you're like on that narcissistic, that extreme.
Yeah.
How many of those are like serial killers, rapists?
Yeah, I think that kind of behavior moves over into sociopathic behavior. I don't think that's not to say that doesn't happen. But I think once we're in that field, we're talking about a whole other personality disorder. It's worse, but not by a long shot. Like right. It's a trip over the line.
Yeah, it's almost like that side of the spectrum. There's something that happened. I mutilated somebody. So that it's identifiable.
Yes.
Versus if it's not identifiable and you're going flown under the radar for years on end, that's like death by a thousand cuts, if you will.
That's it right there. That is such a good analogy. And I've heard other people say that too. It is death by a thousand cuts and nobody can see it. You've got these little cuts between your fingers, you go to a therapist and say, look, and they can't see it, right? Mm. And a therapist that doesn't get it, I should right. say. Not that they're not good therapists, but they're just not trained to look, to know what to look for.
Yeah. So going back to the family dynamic and from the child getting ready to have their own family, like, how does that distinguish? Because there's got to be some, if you know that your parent is a narcissist, mm-hmm. does it sway the daughter or the son to not have kids in a sense? I guess that to me, there's got to be like a really like gray area of what do we do? I'm worried that I may be a narcissist to my kids and so on and so forth. Yeah. And so I'd like to hear a little bit more about that, yeah. that mentality of things, because it's interesting.
It is super interesting. And I've never read any research on this. Such a good question. I've never read any research on that specifically, but I will tell you anecdotally, I've seen a lot of women bypass their child bearing years to not have children specifically because of that. Just in my little corner of the world, I've seen that, because what a scary thing to grow up and think you could do that to your own child. So I think it's common.
And even those that, and there's the other side of the coin where you don't know your parent is a narcissist until it's too late.
Yes.
And now you do have kids, and there's got to be this mentality of once you find out that your parent is a narcissist, oh my God, what have I done to yes. my son or daughter that yeah. kind of makes them think that, right?
Yes.
So there's got to be that line there too.
Every single client that has kids, this is what happens. If they've been raised by a narcissistic parent, I see this. I see so much regret in the parents, like that they didn't realize sooner what was going on.
They would have decided never to have kids.
Yeah. But that's sad too, right?
That's a sad thing.
Yeah.
Like, to go back and actually think that, like, I wish I wouldn't have kids.
Now. Yeah. That's devastating. But I see people beat themselves up a lot about that. I met with somebody this morning that did this exact thing, a client this morning, but it's really common. I think what happens when they realize that their parent was a narcissist, they start to go through and go, oh, I did this and I did this and I did this. Mm-hmm. And that was so damaging. And then they do take like an inventory of all the horrible things they think they did, beat themselves up. And that just, children of narcissistic parents already have low self-esteem. So that just pushes them down even farther. It is not a pleasant situation to be in by any stretch of the imagination.
I'm a coach. You're giving me so much. I want to start reading books about this stuff because you're identifying some traits that I see in clients, right? Mm-hmm. When it comes to, and that's why I'm a big proponent of fitness being a part of somebody's mental health versus a weight loss or an image
yes.
of a body type, right?
Yeah.
Because I think fitness, that's what fitness has done for me, right? It's given me a sense of confidence in myself.
Yeah.
Allowed me to come and step into a podcast and do a podcast when I struggle with speaking and reading and writing and all these other things, mm-hmm. right? Once abuser or abusee of narcissistic parents starts gray rocking, right? So they gray rock their parents. Is there something else that they could be doing besides gray walking? It sounds like gray rocking is just like the first step.
It's the baby step. It is the baby step. There's a whole boundaries are the next step, like really strong boundaries. And what I always hear people say is they're never going to abide by that, right? People need to remember the boundary is for you. It's not for them. So one thing I tell clients, I had a client, her mom would call her all the time and she would call my mom. I have to answer it and I have to talk to her. And they'd be on the phone for 2 hours, right? So a little boundary there is answer the phone if you feel like you need to. I have 10 minutes. I'm on my way to work or I'm on my way to do something. Boundary. What's up, mom? Or something like that. But that's what boundaries can look like. And I think too, and this sounds silly, but I often tell my clients to go practice saying no in the mirror, because you're not used to it. If you've been with a narcissist, you're not used to having any autonomy really. So go in the mirror and look at yourself saying no and realize it's not scary. You can say no. And no is a full sentence too. You can say that doesn't work for me. It feels really scary because they think there's going to be such a consequence, but there's going to be a consequence regardless. How do you protect yourself and how do you bring a sense of peace into your nervous system? Because their nervous systems are all screwed up too. Yeah.
And setting boundaries is such a key thing. I had to tell myself this in dealing. And so I grew up in addiction mm-hmm. myself. So those kind of things happened. And there were certain triggers that I would allow me, want me, like that would trigger me to go use again. And some of those were with my mom. Mm-hmm. And so I loved my mom to death. I opened up my gym because of my relationship with my mom. Aww. And I love her. I love everything about her. However, I can only handle certain amount of time with her. It just didn't mean I didn't love her.
Yeah.
Didn't mean I didn't care for her. Didn't mean I wanted there's any bad to happen to her. Mm-hmm. And I don't even know if my mom was a narcissistic or not, but I do. My mom definitely pulled the guilt trip a lot. And so I think there was definitely traits there. But the boundary setting, would you recommend somebody who's being abused by a narcissistic mom to go, okay, here's the boundary. Is it 1 hour? Is it 2 hours? How do they determine? I just learned by trial and error that after an hour and a half to 2 hours was my limit.
Yeah.
I started getting like frustrated, flustered, angry, annoyed, like just rages. Some, oh my God, like after 2 hours of being with my mom, who I love to death, I cannot stand next to her for more than 2 hours. It's like and it was only brought to my attention because of my wife. My wife is like, you're always loving, you're always caring, you always do this. But then after this time, it's you're just an asshole, dude.
Yeah.
And it was like, and so how would you recommend somebody who's being abused by a narcissistic parent to set that boundary, right? Setting firm boundaries. How would you recommend that they jump into that?
Time limiting everything. I really think that's really important. And I could literally stay here all day with you guys talking about this.
We got time.
It's time limiting everything and recognizing that a narcissist is an energy vampire. So when you notice yourself, I can't talk apparently, but if you start noticing yourself yawning, you're feeling some fatigue, you're feeling overwhelmed, you're maybe getting a little foggy and drifting off in your thoughts, not really fully present, that's time to leave. Because it is an energy, emotional energy drain to be around these people, even if they're on their best behavior, especially with a parent that you've got so much history with too. I know with any parent, but with my mom, she can just have a look on her face and I know exactly what it means, right? And I can be like, oh, don't have that look, right? That's the kind of energy that I'm talking about. You're going to notice these little nuances that are happening and you're feeling it, and it's just like a weight that gets heavier and heavier on you. And you have to pay attention to that. You have to pay attention to what your intuition is telling you too. And when you've been raised in a toxic family or been around somebody who's toxic for a long time, you turn off your intuition or your connection to it. All of us have this little voice that's saying, time to go, or don't listen to that, or whatever it is, right? That's your intuition talking to you. But this is, again, going back to childhood development. A child is always told they're wrong about that intuition or just about their reality, right? There's so much of that in narcissism too. No, you didn't. That's what gaslighting is. That didn't really happen. You didn't really feel that way. So a kid learns to turn off that intuition or that trusting your gut. So it's time to tune back into that. Notice in little moments like that, just notice. I give this example a lot too. I got in an elevator once and we had an office in Mission Valley. Got in an elevator. I was in the elevator. Somebody else got in, stood next to me, and it felt like that whole side of my body lit on fire, which is really, there was such a strong reaction. I didn't know what it was. I did not know this person from Adam. I got off the elevator. Prior to that, I probably wouldn't have. I would have just, there's something wrong with me. But now it's like something sparks. I'm like, okay, if there's something telling me to get off the elevator, I'm going to do it. So I think it's really important to get in tune with that intuition, because we've ignored it for a long time if we've been with a narcissist.
So it's like triggers, right? And I talk about addiction and everything else. That there's in the healing process, there's also got to be the triggers that are just like, oh, okay, you get in the elevator,
yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Man,
but it's a feeling. It is a trigger, dude.
Yeah.
And I will allow that to be a part of the trigger. But it really was what we're just talking about, which is a feeling. It was just a feeling. It wasn't, And so I talk about it like you step into a room of entrepreneurs and the energy's high and you can totally feel like you're in a room with a bunch of lions that are sitting there. I got to be on my A game. Like I'm the alpha here. Or you step into a room of people that are like wanting to listen to what you have to say. Yeah. And you're like, okay, now I got to be the nurturer. I got to provide information. And being self-aware was something that was taught to me out of rehab, dude.
Okay.
And so that was the one thing. If you get the urge to use, it's too late.
Yes.
And so it was like, and so the same thing applies with stepping out of your marriage. I've given this coaching cue to some one of my clients. It's like, what is the one thing you need in the relationship all the time? What do you value most in your relationships? Well, and men, I was talking to a man in this particular case, and he was like, I don't know, sex. And I was like, nah, dude, it's more than that. Sex is 5 minutes if you're lucky, bro. And he's like, no, I really like it if you just like cuddles with me on the couch.
Yes.
That just makes me feel like, what does that make you feel like? It's like, oh my God. And so it's like, the minute you stop cuddling with your wife, you've already cheated on her.
And path.
Yeah. And so is that, and that's what I mean by that. It's not that just a trigger. In rehab, they tell you, like, move the line forward. Mm-hmm. Bring it closer to you. It's, if I already know that I'm going to have a relationship with, I have a toxic relationship with my mom or my dad or whoever the hell you're having the, what is that feeling when you walk into the room? Oh, they're already on a down. They're looking to reflect their shame on me when I walk into the room. Then immediately that line gets moved, dude. Mm-hmm. Like if my mom was on a sick one, dude, I would be like, you know what, dude? 2 seconds, I'm out. I'm out. I can't. Dude, but if she was like in a party, like where she's on her best behavior, then it's 2 hours.
Okay.
Do you follow what I mean?
Yeah.
And so it's not just a trigger. It really is a feeling of when you walk into a room or when you exchange with somebody. Like we're exchanging with Brenda right now. I feel like I wanted to cry right now when she said, oh, I'm a change maker. I'm like, oh, geez. I love you right now.
I saw that.
You know what I mean? So it's a feeling, right? Yeah. And that's what I want to make sure that, because people, when they say triggers, it's almost like, I tripped over the water bottle that's in front of me. Like I'm waiting for that to happen. No, it's way before that.
Yes. And there's
way before
there's
that.
Explanations when it comes to the triggers too. I totally get that. So
a trigger is an echo of a memory.
Yeah,
it is. And so it's a memory of when you felt that pain before and you're just walking into it over and over again.
Yeah.
This has been an unbelievable.
This is powerful, dude.
I could definitely stay here. I want to make sure that we respect your time.
Yeah. It's a little warm in here, too. Yeah. I'm sure I'm beat red.
Yeah, we call it the hot box, usually.
Yeah, thank you very much for coming here, opening up, and having this conversation with us. Because, again, like I said, I think this is, it's unfortunate that narcissists and narcissism is like the trendy word that gets thrown out there for almost anything now if you're being a little bit selfish on something.
Yeah.
And the explanation needs to be talked about a little bit more and how people can heal from that.
That's the important part right there. I mean, it's all important, but you're right. Calling everybody a narcissist waters down when there's an actual narcissist and what damage they actually cause. That really bothers me too.
I know that there's a ton of people out there that are trying to figure out how to heal from that and don't really know how to even start having these conversations and being able to listen in on a podcast like this. I know it helps like one person out.
Yeah.
That's really all that matters.
That's why we started it, man, to be honest with you.
You're in San Diego. So if anybody has any questions or wants to outreach to you, where can they find you?
Narctrauma.com. Narctrauma.com.
Spell that for us.
NARCTRAUMA.com.
Perfect.
Short for narcissist, obviously,
and they can contact you or schedule appointments there? Or?
Yep, there's everything. There's a plethora of information there, too. I've written a ton of blog posts. All the other podcasts I've been on, my own podcast is on there now. There's just tons and tons of resources.
What's the name
of
your plug that, please. Yeah.
So I'm very proud of this, but it's Two Queens and a Joker, My Narcissist Ex and Me. And it is literally his other ex-wife and I have done a podcast together.
I got to listen to. So what is it called again?
Two Queens and a Joker, My Narcissist Ex and Me.
Wow.
We're having a blast. And I just love her. She's become family to me now. So
you guys have so much to relate over.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. And she had children. There's 5 children amongst all the kids. And he had another relationship early on. So that came, and then her kids and my kids. So we're just mothering the kids and healing together.
I love that.
Yeah, it's been great.
So Brenda, thank you so much, Brenda.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
This is fun.
Been an international podcast transmission of No Fixed Agenda presented by Bubs Naturals. Music was provided by The Poor Dirty Astronauts with lyrics written by Matt Meyer. You can rate, review, and subscribe to our podcast on Apple, Spotify, Amazon, or wherever you find your favorite podcast episodes. NFA, over and out.